This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Free Dreamlanders, you're going to enjoy this whole show without interruptions from ads, because it's so important that you hear this and absorb it. This is not a big deal for profit website. It's about information. It's about making contact work. And that means you too, even if you don't pay or can't pay. We have to serve you as best we can. And a show like this, packed with extraordinary information, information that you may be able to use and that will help you to understand as this process becomes more and more intense, is essential. It's essential. So I urge you to go to unknowncountry.com and step up and subscribe. Participate in the social media on the site. Our social media is very different from Facebook or the others. We don't collect your information. We don't sell it. We're just there for you. For you. And we're there for you because some of the money comes from our subscribers and some comes out of my pocket. That's the way it's always been and the way it always will be. I hope you will join us soon on unknowncountry.com as a fully paid subscriber. And now, let's go on to one of the more remarkable shows we've ever done. Listen close. There's a lot here. John Ramirez has returned to Dreamland. He is back with us. He was with us on October the 1st of 2021 when he gave us a fascinating and important set of instructions about how to address the intelligence community with Freedom of Information Act requests. And the reason he could do that is that he has 25 years of experience as an intelligence officer. He's now retired. He has extensive knowledge about how the U.S. intelligence community collects information, which agencies collect which kind, and how to use FOIA requests. But there's much more than that. John has really deep knowledge of how the Airborne Object Identification Management Synchronization Group, and I think we're supposed to stumble over that, and we'll talk about that, is going to work as it becomes the collection point for UAP information from around the military and intelligence community. And we're going to talk about that. But before we talk about that, one of the things we touched on the last time we were together, and we touched on it just very briefly again in our subscriber discussion with John last week, is the Russians' attempts to deal with this phenomenon and their attempts to, if you will, to attract its attention would be the best way to put it, wouldn't it, John, I think?
Right. That's correct, Whitley. So the basis of this information was an interview conducted with a former Soviet and Russian Major General, Vasily Alexeyev. And he was associated with the Russian Air Force. And this interview was taken by a Russian journalist at the Space Communications Center in Moscow, 1997. And in the interview, he stated that during the Soviet era and afterwards, there was a policy from the Soviet leadership to attract or lure one of these UFO craft. And there were various methods that the Soviet military used, such as using field delights, so which basically is a telescope, an instrumented telescope. And people asked, you know, what does that mean, an instrumented telescope? And so it's one that can, like, has some kind of range finding capabilities. It may have a laser range finder on it. And It's designed to track objects. It was used as part of the Russian missile program, test program. So when the Russian missile will re-enter, the warheads will re-enter the atmosphere, they can put a camera on it and watch it come down and then collect scientific data, technical data through this telescope. So it's not just like an astronomical telescope where you look through it and you see like the moon, the planets, and the stars. There's some instrumentation that can be recorded as data. And so it's very similar to what was used for some of our ballistic missile launches. As the missile went up, you know, there were cameras collecting that information. As the missile came down at Kwajalein Atoll, there were also cameras recording that reentry. So it's a similar type of device. It's just used for evaluating the missile launch and its success and having the reentry vehicles enter the atmosphere and do what it's supposed to do. So he said that type of instrumentation was used. And also he mentioned that the Soviet leadership wanted to use the radar stations to do the same. And so the radar stations are not the deployed radars around the Soviet Union at the time. These were the radars that were located at Sarishagan Missile Test Center. And these radars were designed for the similar purpose of evaluating the performance of a Russian missile as they were testing it. And the radars in question were designed for extremely long range. They were designed to detect objects outside the atmosphere in space. They have those kind of ranges, remarkable ranges. Like one was like 6,000 miles and the other was like 9,000 miles. So these aren't like the radars at the airport. So with these radars and with the waveforms they use and the bandwidths they use, radio frequencies they use, they were able to attract some of these craft and actually coming down, not just like up in the sky, like our FA-18 encounters in the sky, chasing them with aircraft. This was on the ground. And so that's the major difference. So it's not something that, as far as I know, that we've tried on the U.S. side. I might be mistaken, but again, I'm not cleared for any of this anymore. I've had no clearances since 2009, but I use informed speculation, knowing the knowledge I had from that time, and then extrapolating that knowledge to something that might be occurring now. So I think that's the explanation that the Major General said, that we use these radars and these devices, perhaps with like lasers, to lure these craft down. Now, what's really interesting, Whitley, is that when the craft was lured down, and let's assume that that really happened. I know it's all speculation, and we only have this Major General's statements. But let's assume for a moment that they were able to do this. What's remarkable is that the Major General then said that the humans on the ground were able to induce or interact with the craft and induce some kind of synchronous motion. So he mentions certain body movements, certain waving of the arms, and the craft would do the same. So, you know, if you raise your hand up, the craft will rise up. If you like lean toward one side, the craft will lean that way. If you move your arms in a certain direction, the craft would then tilt in that direction and so forth. And this is like a way of, according to the Major General, of establishing that first communication. So that was what the Major General said. Now, there's nothing I know in intelligence circles that could verify what he said. I would say this, though, that, you know, these radars were used in some fashion that they were tracking something in the exo-atmosphere, that is outside the atmosphere, when there were no Russian missile tests. So no missiles to track, but yet these radars were activated and they were tracking something. We know enough about these radars to determine, you know, test modes. We know about these radars so that we know when they're using it for training purposes of the Russian space troops, or they're using it for testing new modes of operations. We know what that would look like. But what we saw, in the absence of any missile tests, these radars producing track beams, tracking something in the sky, up in space, because that's the range of the radar. And they were using various modes of operation as if there was a ballistic missile flying downward in the reentry mode from the space to within the atmosphere into impact. So that's the only correlation I have, that they were scanning the sky, then able to acquire the target, produce track beams to track a target down. And we can determine that the beam was moving. There are ways that we can determine that. I can't really talk about, but there are ways that we can analyze these signals and determine the behavior of the signals in the absence of actually being there. So something like that did happen, and it happened during the time that the Major General talked about. It was during the 80s and into the 90s, and through the latter part of the 90s and into the 2000s, these radars weren't as active as they used to be. At this time, the Russian government didn't have the resources to do these missile tests, and there was really not a need for the Russian government at the time, the Russian military, to continually test these missiles. So they didn't really have the resources back then, and the radars basically were left to their own devices, and they basically, I saw pictures of one of the radars, and it was basically in ruins. They didn't keep upkeep, was not there anymore. That's not true anymore. In 2016, Vladimir Putin ordered the Ministry of Defense to refurbish all of those radars. And that, to me, means that now the intelligence community is, again, collecting against these radars. And I have no information about that because I'm no longer cleared. But so from going from there, we have a situation where the Russians claim that they made contact in some way, whether beings came out of the craft and made some kind of contact with the humans on the ground. I have no idea. But they're definitely interacted with these craft in a more direct way than just flying around and chasing it with an F/A-18.
Well, that's very interesting. And the description of having the craft move, in other words, when they would move their hand, the craft would move. I know of people who've had that experience and who said a very interesting thing. It felt like the thing was part of my body. In other words, it felt like an extension of my hand when I moved my hand and the craft moved. And so there's what develops, at least as far as I've heard, very quickly is a kind of symbiosis between the individual who is in this contact situation and what is there that's very, very different from anything that we experience in our ordinary lives. Mm-hmm. Now, this leads me to another question, of course, because there is a real dangerous state right now between the West and the Russians. And I'm wondering if they have acquired any skills from this type of interaction, and what skills can be acquired, as far as I know, are skills of things like intervening in the mental processes of other people. That is, I don't want to use the word mind control because that's it's not like that. It's more a matter of being able to channel people into doing things that they didn't otherwise expect to do, and they end up in the wrong place at the wrong time, for example. Mm-hmm. So do you think it's possible that technology like that, and it is in fact technology, I feel fairly sure, has been acquired by the Russians from their experience with these entities, in which case, you know, they will have a remarkable success in any military operations that they might engage in Europe. And maybe that could be one of the reasons that they're even willing to try what is seemingly a hopeless quest to put up a Russian army against the much more powerful forces of NATO.
Well, Willie, that's in the area of pure speculation, where we have a nexus of geopolitical events on planet Earth amongst we, the terrestrial citizens of planet Earth, and this phenomenon. I can't address that. I don't know if
okay.
we're able to exploit any technology from a alleged interaction with the phenomenon. So I don't know. I want to add one thing. When I describe the interaction, the physical interaction with the phenomenon, the Major General says something very interesting, and it's something that people who have experienced the craft would say, that it came down as an orb. It came down as an orb of energy, and that when they did these interactions with waving of the arms, it would flatten out more into a saucer shape and then came back into an orb. So it was just doing what the DNI's preliminary assessment termed signature management. It was like changing its appearance with the humans. As
yes.
far as any communication between that encounter and with the humans on the ground, I'm not sure if the Major General really addressed that. And I need to source UFOevidence.org as the report that they talked about this Major General. And so I don't have any direct, even from the government, any kind of open source that they were released under FOIA about this. What we have is a interview by a Russian journalist with a former Soviet Major General describing this. But in his description of this, back in the 90s, when we didn't even know about Tic Tac, you know, it sounded kind of like plays true to a lot of what people have said since and their experiences. And I would point out that experiencers are not prevalent in the government's investigation of this phenomenon, and I think it should be. It's always about the military side.
Yes.
You're able to collect militarily or through intelligence community sensors. I really hope that through AOI-MSG, a mouthful, that part of this would be talking to experiencers, not just military folks, not just intelligence community folks, but us, we who've experienced this. They really
yes.
need to seriously to help them understand the scope of what they're seeing with their sensors.
In a moment, I want to go to the Airborne Object Identification Management Synchronization Group. You know, it's so hilarious that they were so careful to choose a completely mouth-filling acronym that cannot work at all. But I'm going to start with a brief discussion of the UAP threat assessment that is already on the table. But before we go there, I think that you've mentioned your own experiences. And if you could say what you would like to say or about this aspect of it to background my listeners a little bit, I think that would be helpful. I'm sure that question is in every single mind of everyone who is listening now or watching.
About general experiences?
Your experiences.
Yes. Well, as I said in many other interviews, it occurred over a lifetime, and I didn't know the meaning of it other than that I was like I was able to see things that they wanted to convey to me. It was always like a message they wanted to convey to me. Whether through my interactions with them medically, I was examined in some medical form. I don't know if at that point they placed some device in me to communicate with me or not. And again, to your point, it's not about mind control. It's more about communication. It's more like,
yes,
we want to know where you are, and we know where you are, and we want to communicate with you or enable you to see things that others might not be able to discern. And in some ways, that communication is facilitated through just mindful meditation. I've practiced mindful meditation for a long time. And in the 60s, you know, I was amongst the young people who got interested in Eastern religions, having grown up in an Eastern religion in Japan called Shintoism, which is like an animism, where like life is everywhere. There's a spiritual entity and everything we see, the rocks, the trees, every creature on the earth, humans, are all linked together. So I grew up in that kind of environment, as I was growing up, because I was, you know, presented before a Shinto priest as a young child, and, I wouldn't call it consecration, but, you know, there was the laying of hands or whatever. I don't remember exactly what happened, but there was a formal introduction into the Shinto religion. I think all Japanese children used to go through in the 50s. I don't know if they still do it now. So I had that background as well. But it's more like a messaging that, you know, there's a message, and we want to convey this message to those that we've selected, I guess you would say, maybe based on like previous familial lines that I know my great grandmother, a Cherokee Indian woman, full blooded, was thought to have been something like a medium. And she was the one that told my father, that would be her grandson, the fact that the Cherokee Nation considers Atlantis to be a real thing. It's part of their the idea that it was an advanced civilization back in Earth's forgotten history that may have done, may have had something to do with how we as humans developed, evolved, that may have happened. And so my father conveyed that to me and said, you know, son, you know, your great grandmother was sort of like a, I guess he called it a medicine woman or something, but,
yes,
had information, and she, and the people around her in her Cherokee Nation community would go to her for this type of information, and that she would heal them, using like traditional methods. So I had that in my background as well. So maybe because of that and previous to that, I don't know, before that, I've never really done an ancestry kind of genealogy of my background. Maybe I was like then naturally selected, I would say, to have this encounter with our visitors. So it's always been a message. It's for me, and I know it differs for with different people. For me, it's never been malevolent. In the sense that they wanted to do me harm. It's not exactly benevolent, but let's say it's like I've described it before. It's like going to the doctor with the worst bedside manner. It's very methodical.
That's really well put, boy. Yeah. The just, doctors I went to had actually a negative bedside manner, I would say.
Right. The worst ever. And so they're doing a job, and it looks like they're very methodical. They're doing a job. And they need to do this job in a way that, you know, that's not really, you know, making you feel comfortable, but they do the job. And so, perhaps it's an examination of us, perhaps an extraction of genetic materials from us. I think that happened to me, based on the, pattern of, it's a skin condition I had around my groin after this experience of being taken aboard a craft and placed on an examining table. The next morning, I woke up with this pattern as if they placed some device over that area. And at that time, I was already in adolescence. So that's my clue, I guess you could say, that they may have extracted some genetic material from me.
Yes.
So I don't know why that is. Some people have reported when they have these experiences of seeing little children and being told that these children were like part of them and part of us, and they're on board the craft. I did have one experience that was kind of very, very strange. And it was after I retired. It was probably 2011, thereabouts. I was retired for a few years. And that was when I felt myself on board a craft and flying on the craft and looking out. I don't know if you call it a porthole or a window or whatever. I could see other craft flying in formation. And the craft shape was not a saucer. The front part of it was curvilinear, but at the what in the Navy we call it the aft end or the stern or the back end, it was more of a crescent shape. So it was kind of a saucer from one aspect, but if you see it, it was basically curvilinear with a crescent shape back end, and at landing on some surface, exiting this craft, walking to another craft that landed, and a female personage came out, a female individual that was not human, but was humanoid. And she was introduced as my daughter. She says, "I'm your daughter." And I had a conversation with her that I don't recall. This is ripe for another QHHT session, the quantum healing hypnosis technique, to try to remember what may have occurred. But there was some like conversation, and I did feel an affinity toward this woman that, you know, like she was part of me, and she felt this affinity toward me as well. So there was some familial connection that it's very difficult to explain. And I say this for the experiencer audience that maybe perhaps you have experienced something similar to the nuts and bolts. And by the way, UFOs don't have nuts and bolts. So I don't know why we call them nuts and bolts, but you know what I mean. The folks
they don't.
That are primarily interested in the craft, the physical craft, its propulsion system. There are people that just want to focus on that. It would seem like, you know, like, fanciful, you know, like this is just craziness. But for experiencers, it might resonate that they may have had similar experiences. And from going forward, I'm more interested in dialoguing with experiencers more than the nuts and bolts. I'll use that physics crowd, the scientific crowd, which just want to like take physics and apply it to this phenomenon without any of the higher consciousness aspects, without any of the experiencers and the channelers. And I think they're missing a big part of why they're here.
Well, I think so too. And I don't think that they can succeed doing that simply because the higher consciousness aspect and the physics are so intertwined. There's no way that you can, like, you're not going to be able to fly one of these craft, if you're sitting there like a, if you're not consciously able to do that, that requires an ability to let your, to first of all, to know that you have a soul and you can, and or a second body, I should say, as well as a first body. There's a soul there too, but that you have these other levels of being. Because as soon as you touch what you need to touch in it, you're going to feel as if you have become the craft itself. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know what you're doing, you're certainly not going anywhere.
Right.
So that's, go ahead. Yeah.
Yes. And that's an interesting take, Whitley, because anecdotally, and I can't find that source anymore, some source quoted Drinvalo Melchizedek saying that the government offered him basically a blank check to see using the Merkava techniques to see if he could fly something that was in the possession of the government because it had no propulsion. It was basically
correct.
The entire craft would become part of the consciousness of the pilot so to speak. And without a pilot able to make that linkage through higher consciousness, the craft is just basically a hunk of metal.
Right. But it's not quite a hunk of metal because, well, let's not go down that path because it's not where we're, what we're here to talk about too much, but it is a fact that unless you have a clear aim, is what I would say, that you won't, even if you do manage to touch it in the right way.
Yeah.
You're okay. Not going anywhere.
Right.
Because it is becoming part of you and you are part of it. But this business of the isolated consciousness inside the body, the thing that at least the US military is and are the people who are trying to make this work are confused about is that they think that is isolated. But as soon as you actually engage with this thing, your consciousness is no longer bordered by your body. It is in the skin of the craft, which is a very different system.
Yeah.
It's not like regular metal at all. And right. Then you are, your sense of individuality is changed profoundly. You are somebody with objectives and aims that have to do with that craft. And your wishes become its journey, and and its journey become your wishes. I guess that's the best way of describing what that's like.
Right. That's a good way of describing it. When I say hunk of metal, I was alluding to the fact that
it's a hunk of metal without that. That's for sure.
If the government has that type of craft in its possession, if other countries have that type of craft in their possession, it's not doing anything for them. So they're trying to make it fly and they don't know how, because there's no like ignition switch, so to say.
Well, what I suggested was launch. I suggested to Chris Mellon and Hal Puthoff that if they have a craft, they should put it in the Smithsonian. And both of them said that's unlikely to happen. But the truth is, we're never going to learn how to fly it unless the public has access to it. Simple as that.
Exactly.
And someone is going to come along, probably some 12-year-old version of Melchizedek, Drunvalo Melchizedek, and walk up to it, and all of a sudden, it's going to turn on. That's what will happen, but not behind closed doors.
Yes. A starseed or star child will visit the museum, and all of a sudden it rises up.
Exactly. That's what I thought would probably happen. And
yes.
I think they suspected that too. But
yes.
as far as I know, we're going to stay at ground zero. And when I say stay at ground zero, that means that we're going to continue to have this wall between us and our visitors. Mm-hmm. And
right.
The wall is secrecy.
Is secrecy. And so, you know, I don't want to talk too much about the my lab's experience, the military abductions, but in some way, this is pure speculation on my part. In some way, I'm wondering if these events occur because the military wants to have perhaps the involuntary cooperation of certain of us who've been visited in that manner, who've had interactions with these higher consciousness beings, and believing that because we have these interactions, perhaps we can fly them and then be taken to some facility with this craft and trying to coax us into flying them.
Yes.
I think Melinda Leslie is probably a good source for that type of discussion.
We had a great discussion with her on Dreamland recently, and she's going to come back soon.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. And then again, you know, it's just only the military. Sometimes it's just only these corporeal visitors, I would say. And sometimes it's a combination of the two. And my question for Melinda would be, okay, so they have this craft. It's an off-world craft. And you have these other non-human beings. Why can't the military just ask them to fly it? Or maybe they can't because they're more corporeal, like us. And that these craft are like another level of visitor that is probably more higher consciousness, consciously developed than some of the other visitors that we see that seem to be more corporeal in nature. I don't know. That's just pure speculation.
Yeah, I think there's something in that because there does seem to be a spectrum, very definitely. You know, we've reached a half hour in the show, and I'm not going to put any ads in this week because I don't want to disturb the flow of the conversation for anybody, because this is not a conversation that could have been had any even a year ago, and so it's valuable. This is valuable material, and folks, listen carefully, and if you don't get it, listen again. And you can always write me questions at whitley@streber.com. I'm always available there. It's my job is not, I'm not a celebrity. My job is to do this, and that means doing it with you. So don't forget that. I also would remind those who don't subscribe to Unknown Country, please, for God's sakes, do it, because this all takes money. It's not free. My expenses on the website are north of $50,000 a year. And I need you to help me. I give as much of my own money as I possibly can. Okay. And I thank those who do help. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. We couldn't be here without you. Now let's move on to the UAP threat assessment and beyond the UAP threat assessment. Mm-hmm. Because the threat assessment came out in December, and the public, we've talked about it. We talked about it on the last show. But what I would like to talk about is your opinion of why it was called a threat assessment, which has been troubling me for a long time, because that leaves it in firmly in the sphere of the military, which is not where it has ever really belonged. It belongs in the academic community to enable a revisit to human mythology in the context of this having been with us for a long time. And it belongs in the scientific community and in the consciousness community too. But here we have a UAP threat assessment. What are we going to do now? Why is it called a threat assessment, John?
Well, for example, like any program in the government requires money. And when you require money, you just can't go to the committees of Congress and say, we want to study this phenomenon and we want to bring in outside consultants. And some of them might not have clearances and they might want to provide us information about their experiences in that regard. And also there might be military and intelligence community people who are also experiencers. And I firmly believe that to be absolutely true. We can't just go to Congress and expect anything to do with this as being funded at any level like that. And so if you make it a threat and they couch it in terms that we don't know what it is, which I don't think is wholly true. But let's say, you know, we don't know what it is and we need to study it more. And, oh, by the way, they're in our airspace and we can't prevent them from flying over sensitive areas of our airspace, the Department of Energy facilities, Department of Defense facilities. They're interested in our most sophisticated sensors. They're like very highly classified sensors and they're poking around looking at them. You know, that you kind of couch it in that type of language, unfortunately, in order to get Congress to pay attention to it, to say, okay, this is important now, and so let's pay attention to it. I credit Senator Gillibrand with at least attempting to bring that civilian science aspect into the study, because I think that's absolutely necessary.
Yes, talk a little bit about what she initially proposed.
Well, she initially proposed, and I think it was called ASRO, ASRO, Airborne Surveillance, and I forgot what the RO, Reporting Office, and then
Reporting Office. That's correct.
Right. Somebody changed it to ASTRO, which like it's a much better acronym.
Right.
Airborne Surveillance. I believe the T is tracking. If I'm mistaken.
Yes.
Reporting Office. So ASRO, ASTRO, whatever you want to call it, was removed from the final NDAA. Also removed was the participation of the SCU and Project LAL. And that's where the civilian side came in, and that was gone from the legislation.
Tell us, if you will, what the civilian side, had it been left in the bill, what would the civilian side have done? And we know Project Galileo is our Avi Loeb's project, but what would the others, what would the, in general, what would the civilian side have been able to do?
Well, there you can bring in expertise from academia into the study of the phenomenon. And more likely than not, the folks in academia would not be cleared for any of this. But having said that, anyone who is a U.S. citizen 18 years and over with no felony convictions and no outstanding warrants can get a secret clearance. And under secret, there's a lot of information under secret. Top secret basically protects sources and methods, very sensitive sources and methods that if revealed, it's not the information necessarily, but if revealed, you can never use those sources and methods again to collect anything, any intelligence. So that's why there's a top secret SCI type of category. But under secret, we could have read in, we meaning my former government employers, could have read in civilian scientists into some level of understanding what's behind the curtain, so to speak. And they would have been able to then bring in their resources in academia. And it could be like not just physicists and engineers, but I'm saying like theologians, I'm saying like philosophers, like get a broader view of it. Because what's important to me is this interaction between the phenomenon and humans. The interactions between the phenomenon and our jet fighters don't interest me in the least. Because we just assume, yeah, they're higher performance than anything we can fly. So just take that, you know, and as baseline. But the interactions with humans, to me, is more important. And doing that, you'll bring in this broader aspect of what I call, you know, exo studies into it. And also, the other part of it is diplomacy, exo-diplomacy, that assuming that we do make contact, that how do we, as a nation, how do we, more importantly, as a planet, interact with these visitors like we would with another country? You know, ambassadors to them, and their ambassadors, their emissaries to us. There's some sort of contact protocol that needs to be discussed seriously. And I think having that there beyond just, you know, air threats, space threats, would have brought the discussion to where I personally believe it needs to go. But that was all out of there. And unfortunately, what we have is more of a DoD-centric view of this is a unknown, unidentified threat to our airspace. I would say that UAP, the U should stand for unacknowledged aerial phenomena, more to the truth that, oh yeah, we know what it is, or we have a strong suspicion what it is, but we don't want to tell you what we think. And so they're allowed to tease little bits and pieces of information, but it's unacknowledged aerial phenomenon, assuming that the government knows a lot more than what we do. And so that was all out of that legislation. And unfortunately, that's out there, but it still opens the possibility that the Department of Defense can then formally contract these other organizations under the federal acquisition regulations and just, you know, do a market survey of who's out there that could help them outside of government and, rack and stack those with their capabilities and then, put out a request for proposal. And a request for proposal, you have a mission statement. You have a statement of work of what is expected of this company. And also you have deliverables, period of performance. All of that goes into an RFP, which I used to write for CIA. So I know the process of getting these companies involved. You invite them. You don't necessarily have to have them all cleared, but they have to have clearable personnel. So they may not come with you with clearances, but as long as they can go through a clearance process, that's all that really matters. So it wasn't the fact that these SCU and Galileo project would not have cleared people. As long as they have clearable people, you're bringing them in and they will then do a pitch, basically a sales pitch. They will then describe their proposal, how they would respond to your request for that proposal. And they'll do slideshows and talk to you, and you can ask questions of them and then evaluate later as a team. You do a technical management evaluation of every proposal and then grade them all. And then the winner at the top will then receive the contract. And then you send all the other folks who did not gain the contract. You send them a letter describing that we're sorry, but, you know, thank you for your effort. Thank you for your proposal. But we did not feel like it met the needs of the government. And that's basically the process. So the department can still do that with these organizations if they so choose. And that's the process which the DIA did with Robert Bigelow for Skinwalker Ranch.
And that's worked out very well, because Robert Bigelow does everything he can to bring into the public space what he's learned and what his group has learned. And, you know, now the Skinwalker Ranch is talk about in the public space. It's been a TV show and everything. And, you know, he's really done quite marvelous work. And at the same time, without knowing anything specific, I'm assuming that he has kept secret the things that he needed to keep secret, primarily things that disclose methodologies.
Yes.
Of observation of the world in the largest sense.
Yes.
That are going to, if they were understood, are going to help our earthly enemies understand what we may be able to know about them and their activities. So, now, what we have here is a picture of essentially of the military and the intelligence establishment kind of clinging to this, because the part of the legislation that was cut out is the part that would, as you inferred earlier, kind of open a sesame and end up with a situation where the Pentagon could no longer control certain aspects of the flow of information.
Yes.
And I have to ask myself always, what is this about? And I think that more than the desire to conceal the materials, because after all, the Russians have the same materials, and not only that, what we've learned about these materials and to a great extent has already been bled out into both the defense and medical industries and is in use now. So that's not the reason. The reason is something else. And I think that it goes back to the blanket denial that has been in place for 70 years. It is a lack of ability to understand and control. And now also knowledge of the close encounter phenomenon in its most negative aspects. And you alluded yourself to seeing a child that was you. And I've had the same experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure many of the people listening to this program have had the same experience. And what can you conclude from that? That it doesn't happen? Of course it happens. It's part of this. And do they really want to say to the general public who has no idea about any of this, that this is part of what happens and we can do nothing whatsoever about it? Of course they don't. So how do we proceed? You have the Airborne Object ID Management Synchronizing Group, which is really an organization designed, I think, to catch leaks more than it is to disclose anything. And right. Yeah, so how do we proceed with this in such a way that science and the academy can have a much more free hand than they would ever get through the process you just described? Is there any way?
That's a great question. And I haven't given it a lot of thought because I can't wrap my head around how that would happen, knowing how, not necessarily how the Department of Defense thinks, but how the intelligence community, CIA, would think. I would think that the other piece of legislation that is on being discussed is the Intelligence Authorization Act for fiscal year 22. And the significance of that is the NDAA is mostly about the Department of Defense, its military, whereas the IAA is more about the DNI and the civilian side of the intelligence community. And that seems to be more open to discussing and considering those aspects you just mentioned, Whitley, because the CIA, after all, is the agency that dealt with MK Ultra,
right?
Exploring consciousness, exploring mental behaviors, mind behaviors, brain behaviors, and within the DNI. There's that counterpart to DARPA, D-A-R-P-A. It's I-A-R-P-A. And through that organization, the Intelligence Advanced Research activity, they're probably more open to taking those aspects into account. Because in IARPA, there has been a lot of research into like the human mind, and so they consider that as part of intelligence. How does the human mind work? And ostensibly, that's to determine, you know, like what motivates a world leader to make decisions. What motivates individuals in that leadership, the military individuals, to act the way they do or believe the way they do? How do we understand what would motivate a person of another country, a citizen of another country, to give up secrets of that country? And so there's like brain mapping activity at the IARPA. There's psychometrics, I guess you would call it. All of that is there. And so the product of like what the agency did with MK Ultra with remote viewing, the end product of that was kind of put together into this IARPA organization to be able to look at things that don't necessarily answer current intelligence questions of policymakers, but broaden that and be more universal, if I dare say, be more cosmic in its approach to everything that we're seeing. So that's my hope, that the IAA would then be under the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and she has more direct tasking authority over the Director of Central Intelligence Agency to have that type of study under the CIA auspices. And so under CIA, that's been done historically since the time of Roswell. Shortly thereafter, in 1949, CIA stood up this Office of Scientific Intelligence and under it a life sciences division to study the UFO phenomena. And I've said before, life sciences, Whitley, includes medical personnel, neuroscientists, psychologists, psychiatrists, behavioral scientists, all of that. They were studying UFO. And so they weren't studying like they're not aerospace engineers looking at how these things fly. They were looking at what we have needs to be explained in the terms of its our encounter with it, the phenomenon, and the phenomenon's encounter with us, the humans. So that's why you have a life sciences division there, to study those aspects. When we encounter those, the phenomenon, a human encounter the phenomenon and have these experiences, report the experiences, is there any kind of change in the brain that we can detect? That's the kind of like thing they were looking at. And that's under CIA. So it's not like it's a threat, but we want to understand, why is this occurring? Why are these encounters delivering messages to experiencers and what those messages might contain? And so that grew into effort there to look at all of that. And eventually evolve into remote viewing program. And those who study the remote viewing program would know that remote viewers such as Joe McMonagall remote viewed Mars and found that, there was a civilization on Mars, and that civilization was delivered onto Earth, and there might be Martians from that civilization who were very tall. And he describes it in many talks that I've listened to when he was a guest at, conferences. There were very tall Martians, and they came to Earth. That's part of the remote viewing record. Another remote viewer, Mel Riley, the late Mel Riley, under the facilitator Ed Dames, remote viewed a galactic headquarters, and seeing himself being placed on a table and surrounded by beings. So that's also in the CIA's records.
Yes.
It's obvious that at some level of government, there's some attention paid to that aspect of the phenomenon above and beyond that's an interesting advanced propulsion craft. Let's study it, or let's make another one. That discussion, that might be a legitimate, military, national security discussion. But for us humans, living here on this planet, and working toward making a better planet, and correcting things that we've done to the planet to harm the planet, that message needs to be paid attention to, by the government, I think.
I think so too. Right now, as I'm speaking, it is about 82 degrees in Santa Monica, California, on an afternoon in February the 10th, 2022. And that suggests that something is really very wrong, because it should be at least 20 degrees cooler. And that normal weather won't return until next week. And there's going to come a time fairly soon, I think, when the normal weather will not return. And this is true all over the planet. The planet is in an extinction event right now. And this was predicted by warnings to Close Encounter witnesses all the way back for years and years. And yes. the two things we know, there's all kinds of channel material about what they say and don't say, et cetera. And I don't discount that. But I don't trust it as much as two other things. First is that this message, which is almost universal among Close Encounter witnesses, that they have been told this. And then second, the fact that nuclear weapons are dangerous. And this has been illustrated by the many incursions into nuclear missile facilities that have occurred both in Russia and in the United States, and possibly in China for all I know, although until very recently when they began a dramatic expansion of their nuclear missile capability, they didn't have many missiles. So all of that put together suggests that our visitors, at least they do want us to survive, whether it's for our it's altruistic or because they want more of the children that you saw and that I have seen. I don't know, but it could be a mixture of things. My point, though, is this. Unless we engage the mind of the public. And the public realizes that this message is real, and it's coming from a very high source. Its impact is almost non-existent. It just doesn't matter. And it's going to take some kind of acknowledgement of the, not only of the existence of this presence, but of its importance before the public will respond. And I don't see that happening here. I don't.
Right. I just want to preface that I myself did not see children. I saw a female person.
Okay. I'm sorry to
as my daughter. So I saw a child, that was presented to me as a daughter in one of my experiences. But to your point, yes, what would it take for we as citizens of Earth to come together, and go forward from here to prevent whatever that is occurring. The other side of the equation is perhaps what is occurring will be a catalyst for our visitors to present themselves, because we humans won't be able to prevent that from happening, but they can.
Yes.
They have the technology to do so. In order for on Earth to have support from them to prevent this, we as Earth may need to acknowledge their presence from happening. From keeping this happening in the year 2026 always comes up. It comes up with me as well, 2026. Your guest, Anjali, I think she said 2027, but it's in the same ballpark.
Yes, and we have 2027 from a letter sent to us back in the 90s by a close encounter witness that was given that year. But, you know, there are lots of years have been given over the years. The year the world will end, the year they'll come, the year they'll land, the year everything will change. And those years have come and gone, and nothing has happened. At least nothing we notice.
Right.
Although I do think that, that it's possible.
Yes.
What if it doesn't happen? I mean, I think it's obvious to anyone, certainly to you and me, that the visitors, as you alluded to a moment ago, can change this story immediately if they wish. They can. I mean, what if, speaking of Anjali Schultz, what if she had succeeded in taking a group of scientists into a cave and videotaping aliens on December the 21st of last year? She failed to do that. And
yes.
I knew she would fail, but the second I saw her standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And by the way, folks, if you're listening to this on February the 11th, Anjali will be with us in the subscriber video room tomorrow, February the 12th. She missed last week, and John was with us instead, and we had a wonderful conversation with him. And I'm hoping that John will come back and ask Anjali a few questions as well.
Yes.
Will you, John, do you think?
Yes, and absolutely, Whitley. And again, if I can put a plug in, I am a member as well. And it's the best value you can have if you want to really seriously get into this discussion beyond just craft.
Right.
Really, the core of this, Whitley, I think you do a great job bringing provocative guests, interesting guests to talk about this. And so I've found great value in my subscription and encourage others who are not subscribers to do so.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And back to your point, yes, I don't think it's going to be on our terms. It's going to be on their terms, I think, for them to make their presence known. There's nothing I don't think we as a government or as a people can induce their presence to be known. I think that right now it's more selective. There's certain people they're communicating with.
Yes.
As far as the previous years, I would make an argument that we had shifts in consciousness throughout the planet. Our consciousness has shifted into a higher vibration. And because it's such a subtle shift that we just assume that, okay, we're, you know, we've become more consciously evolved, but that shift has occurred throughout history. I mean, you can go back to like the Renaissance period where there was a shift in consciousness where, oh, the earth isn't flat. You know, there are planets out there, you know, the whole entire Renaissance period, even going forward to dating us, Whitley, the 60s, the Summer of Love period, the start of the New Age was like a shift in consciousness. And there appears to have been a more recent shift in consciousness within the last maybe decade or so. In fact, I used to attend a conference in Charlotte, North Carolina, when I lived there, that was called Shift Charlotte, and it gathered together people of the higher consciousness community, I call it, to gather together for conferences. And we didn't talk about UFOs. We talked about us, people, and how we improve our lives, mindful meditation practices, things that we can do nutritionally to prepare our corporeal existences to be more receptive to that, you know, the health aspects of it and so forth. So that has occurred, and it's still occurring, but it's not widespread, like you said. It might take something earth-shattering, literally, for that that aspect to happen, but it has to happen in a way that people don't panic.
Once they panic, they become completely irrational, even more so than usual.
Yeah, and Brookings Institute, you know, that their paper that the Eisenhower administration commissioned, delivered to the Kennedy administration, it was a part about that. It was profound. It wasn't the entire paper, but there was a section in there about the aspects of the consequences of revealing what is out in space and what they govern you at that point. Let's put a lid on it. You know, let's not like disseminate this right now. We're not ready for it. But I think we're ready now. I really do.
I think we have to be ready because we've run out of time already. Changes in the planet that we are seeing all around us are going to fully express themselves fully. They're not going to be able to be stopped. It's already too late. And, you know, back in the 80s, it was nearly too late. I remember Walter Orr Roberts, who had been approached by the Air Force to be the head of the Project Blue Book thing, refused. He told me that he refused to do it because they told him the outcome was going to be foreordained, that it was going to say that there was nothing in any of this UFO stuff. And so he said, well, I'm not going to do it. And they went to someone else. Mm-hmm. But he also said to me, and this was like in the 90s, must have been the early 90s, that the EPA had information that the planet would overheat over the next 30 years and that it was already unstoppable. And they withheld that information. And because it was so incendiary. And then politics got involved, and we ended up with two political parties, one of them saying this is a great danger, and the other one saying, well, they say it's a great danger, therefore we say there's nothing to it. And so we just ended up frozen, right, as if, you know, and I thought to myself, is it meant to be this way? John, is this part of an acceleration to a level of higher consciousness, the delivery of an incredible, vast planetary shock, and the reason maybe our visitors don't change the situation is that they want this shock to happen?
That's a difficult question to answer. I have my hopes that we won't need that shock to occur to the planet, but I have to look back at the acceleration of information from the government within the last several years. I mean, we've learned a lot since 2017.
Yes.
Almost 5 years in December of 2022. We have been told much more than we were told or not told in the previous many decades.
Yeah, 70 years.
Yes, 75, actually. This will be the 75th anniversary of Roswell.
Right. Yeah.
You know, if you look back at the 50th anniversary, my CIA colleagues and I, we were like watching the presentation by a rather junior Air Force officer describing Project Mogul as the answer. And we felt bad for the guy. And we were saying, oh, I wonder who he pissed off that he got stuck with this duty.
You know,
because he was in an uncomfortable position. He was obviously uncomfortable. And he really did not know what he was talking about. He was just basically reading talking points given to him. You go out there and speak to the press, introducing this Air Force study on Roswell. Case closed, they said, you know. Of course, the case was not closed.
No.
And so, you know, but now, you know, it's a little more accelerated. However, the Air Force is, for some reason, of all the services, the Air Force seems to have put a clamp on it from their own personnel from talking about any of this.
That's right. And that I find is the most disturbing thing that's happening right now.
UAP task force, they were absent, and they're not really on board with anything that's happening. And so if you allow me to speculate about this, it's probably speculation only. I have no information, insider, outsider, whatever. But my personal speculation is, assuming the craft was recovered and assuming that, you know, we know there's enough witness evidence that the craft was delivered to T2 intelligence, which is now became FTD and now NASIC at Wright-Patt. And Wright-Patt, that unit, NASIC, does the foreign material acquisition and exploitation. They do that for just like if they captured or we are able to acquire foreign military technology. They reverse engineer a lot of stuff and trying to figure out how does this work. And so if it went to that and they have it and they decided that they were going to exploit it to the sense that they were going to reproduce something like that. And over the years, as our technology developed to a point where we understand the propulsion system and they can make something fly, if they want to protect that, then I can see where the Air Force was thinking, you know, when all this UAP information comes out and we're called before the carpet, that is Congress, and we're called to bring witness to sworn testimony to Congress, which if we lie, we can commit perjury. Well, that can't happen. We cannot shine any light on this. And so we're just not going to play. That's my take on it. And Chris Mellon wrote a brilliant piece. I encourage your viewers to read the debrief piece Chris Mellon wrote about the Air Force and its involvement with this entire phenomenon. And it's more like, you know, don't say anything, keep it under wraps. They're basically Project Blue Book expanded into the modern era.
Right, which is very disturbing. And now the AOIMSG is inside the Pentagon. In other words, the Air Force is going to have a great deal of influence over what they collect and what they do with what they collect. And I have thought and thought about the Air Force, and I have a deep connection in my family with the Air Force and a deep connection with the Roswell incident, because one of my uncles, as I've said 1,000 times on this show, and General Exon, who was a close friend of his for life, were involved at the Air Materiel Command when this material was brought in, and they were very well aware of it. And so I know it's and yet the Air Force continues to play an increasingly hopeless game, because now everything they say about this is taken to be a lie. And what this does is it feeds this insane super conspiracy theory paranoia that's flowing through the country right now. And because it's not a too long, far a reach from the Air Force is hiding the truth about UFOs and aliens to Hillary Clinton is drinking the blood of children underneath a pizza parlor in Washington. I mean, there's a whole flow there that you, if you go from one, you go inch one, inch two, inch three, inch four, all of a sudden your mind is entertaining completely insane notions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happening. And it all starts with this secrecy, I think, not just the Air Force, but that the whole phenomenon of secrecy is corrupting our minds profoundly.
Right. And so extending that thought that you had, Whitley, is, okay, so giving the benefit of doubt to the military and the Department of Defense back in the day, when we were definitely in a Cold War with Russia and developing nuclear weapons left and right, both sides, okay, if there was any kind of exploitation of anything like that, and under the Cold War construct in context, I can see, okay, we need to keep this secret. The Cold War has been over for a long time.
Yes, and exactly.
So the need to keep something technically advanced like that secret, I don't know why that is, because we have very advanced craft. And so companies like Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, Boeing, they put out a lot of information about projects they're working for the government before they're released.
Right.
For example, you know, if you look at the TR-1, which is a modification of the U-2, they announced, I think, several years ago, 2015, I think, at the Air Force Association convention, annual convention, that there will be a TRX, X meaning some number, and it's going to be a really advanced surveillance aircraft. And they were able to say that in the public domain without having it secret. Lockheed Martin announced that, yes, there's an SR-72, which will have three propulsion systems. And it will be an unmanned, non-piloted vehicle that will take over from the SR-71. And it will do remarkable things because now we don't have to worry about G-forces on humans.
Yes.
They released that. So why is this kept under wraps if they were able to release these other projects of exotic technology, advanced technology? Why is this? And I don't know what the answer is. And anti-gravity is something that, you know, it's been studied in academia.
Yes.
So why is that? I don't know.
Well, one of the reasons is that a high-intensity magnetic field will generate its own gravity if it's high, if it's strong enough. And learning how to create a field like that has been a big issue, I feel sure. I know that the visitors create that field with some kind of a device that rotates at astonishing speed, really fast. If you can imagine a rotational speed that's 20% of the speed of light, you can get an idea of what I'm talking about. And materials that can take that, power that can generate that, and materials that can take that speed, handle that speed, all in a very small container. So if you want to talk about propulsion devices, it's not quite true that we don't know a little bit about propulsion devices. And this is part of that little bit, I suppose. I'm just guessing here.
You're right. I'm not a physicist either, but, you know, I just, the little physics I know, it's mostly electromagnetic part of the spectrum as a technical electronic intelligence analyst for CIA. You know, if they're like the saucer shape can be described as a way of facilitating that. If you think there is like rotating magnetic fluid within that outer ring of the saucer, of rotating at those phenomenal speeds that you talked about, Whitley, that you have two rotating halves of that magnetic fluid. And in the middle, that will induce like an electromagnetic reaction. The electro part of it will be coming, for example, out of maybe the top and around the craft and re-entering the bottom, just circulating over and over again. And that, as you say, it's anti-gravity. In order to bend time and space, you need gravity. So that's kind of a counterintuitive way of thinking it, but you're right. The more gravity you have, you can concentrate gravity in a very small localized space.
Yes.
You will bend, and I call it displace, a temporal spatial displacement will occur in the presence of this intense gravitational force. One of the four classic forces of physics, you know, you have gravity, you have electromagnetism, you have the strong nuclear and the weak nuclear. And so that's a combination of all of that. And so there's been talk about these terahertz wave guides. And just for your audience, terahertz means trillions of cycles per second.
Right.
Trillions of cycles per second. That's a lot of cycles per second of that being a channeler of some of this electromagnetic energy that may circulate from the top to the bottom of, or the bottom to the top of these craft. And so that might explain some of the signature management aspects described in the preliminary assessment that, you know, we just can't focus on it. Even with our sensors, it's difficult to like actually focus on what we're seeing because of that intense field that's produced around it and the colors that people see, you know, blue and orange colors and white and all these other colors might be some aspect of that circulation of magnetic fluid or something that can be magnetized like that and then circulated at extremely fast speeds. I'm not a physicist. And so physicists who are like watching us now will say, John doesn't know what he's talking about. Whitley doesn't know what he's talking about. And I admit, I don't know what I'm talking about because I'm not a physicist at all.
Well, I'll admit the same thing. I think it's much safer for both of us to do so. Yeah. What happens inside that field is very interesting. And this is where the pilots come in. The field creates a bubble in the universe. It's generating its own gravity. It is its own universe.
Mm-hmm.
And within that field, the wishes of the individual become its physics, constrained only by the constants that we all know, that the fine structure constant and the other constants of reality. And so the result of this is that now that the external universe no longer has control over your presence, things like speed depend not on so much on the larger physics of the universe, but of the physics of your tiny little universe. And you can make that thing go really, really fast. And, mm-hmm. and you can make it do all sorts of things, even pass into one level, like air and into water and all kinds of things.
Right.
That's what I think anyway. I'm just guessing.
Right. And it's interesting that there was a Army study, the Intelligence and Security Command, U.S. Army, looked at the Robert Monroe's Gateway experience. And there was a part of that about vortex fields that when remote viewers go into their deep meditation to remote view, that they report feeling a vortex field around them, and that they're able to then transport their consciousness to another place. So that kind of comes into what you were just saying, and what Drinville Melchizedek teaches is how to create your Merkaba or Merkaba field around you. And that is like rotating vortices, top and bottom, that will then enable you to transcend your physical body, your consciousness then ascends. And in fact, I think the actual M-E-R-K-A-B-A broken down basically means a light body vehicle, vehicle of ascension, light body ascension, known to the ancient Egyptians, you know. And so that has a lot of resonance with me. And I felt some of that in deep meditation. And I've said before that I don't need a spaceship to travel out there into the cosmos. I just need me. And if I can create something like that in deep meditation, I've actually gone to, like, why I always go to is an ice planet. It's an icy planet. I don't know why I go there, but that's where I go. And so that's something I haven't really revealed before in any, for any public audience, but when I create that field or some semblance of that field, I get this ice planet. And then from there, I'm presented information from higher consciousness, what some people call source. That's where the information comes from. It's up to me to utilize that information, and I always dedicate these experiences for my good and for the good of all. And that's how I end that experience, and thank the cosmos for allowing me to have that experience. And I go and ask the Earth's forgiveness for all the things that we have done to damage her, and that we'll do better, we'll learn better. And I always get emotional when I talk about that, because to me, that's the core of my experiences. You know, that is the reason for that, is this personal enlightenment, but the ability to share that enlightenment with others and perhaps some way make some kind of change that's positive in someone else's individual life. So I can't make global changes. I don't think that's my mission. That might be somebody else's mission. But I reach out to individual experiencers, and because they have no one to talk to, really. They can't talk to family and friends, and definitely not coworkers, for threat of losing their job.
Right.
And they're holding it all within themselves. And when you talk to these experiencers like that, I mean, you can feel the anguish they have.
Right.
And I'm just a willing person, non-judgmentally listening to them. And sharing, yes, you know, I have the same thing. Others have had the same thing. And just hopefully the experiences will find each other and get together in an experiencer group, you know, or something like that. Yes. You know, Jay King and Stuart Davis have an experiencer group like that, of like-minded experiencers, to share their experiences. You know?
Right. There are more experiencer groups forming, and fortunately, it's not like it used to be, which was very divided between angelic belief in angelic beings and belief in demonic beings. And it's becoming much more sophisticated and nuanced. You know, the world you bring up fascinates me immediately. And the reason is that in my book, A New World, I describe experiences of seeing a mirror, what I think of as a mirror universe. Mm-hmm. And I've been in it physically twice. Mm-hmm. At this mm-hmm. point, maybe three times, but certainly twice. And what is interesting about it is, it appears that the ice age has not ended in that ideation of reality. And I wonder if that's where you're going.
Wow! I just right now my spine is tingling and my skin is. Oh my goodness. Yeah, I'll take that into meditation next time.
And, because you have this Native American blood mm-hmm. in you. And believe me, the people who I met in that world, the most powerful ones, that were three Sioux warriors still wearing the costume of the Sioux as they were, of the Sioux as they were from, of the Lakota Sioux as they were from 200 years ago. And these were powerful, self-empowered, fully true human beings. They had not been damaged by cultural colonization and defeat in any way. They were amazing people. And I have a feeling that this is the world, and you may be able to, knowing this, when you go again, ask maybe for your ancestors to come and be with you. Ask your, was it grandmother or great-grandmother?
Great-grandmother.
Mm-hmm. Ask her. She might be there.
I'll try. I will do this, though. That's very inspiring. Thank you very much. That's a gift.
We have come to the end of our time together, John, and as always, it has been more than amazing. We're two skaters skating around all kinds of stuff, folks, but if you listen carefully, you can learn an awful lot from a conversation like this. Thank you for your time, John, and for your candor, and above all, for your wonderful experience and exceptional intelligence. It's a great pleasure.
Well, thank you, Willie, for this opportunity to once again share with your audience my experiences, which the sharing to me is more important. I don't expect anyone to believe me. That's not my point. I'm not here to sell anything other than I wanted to share my experiences and try to help others who are having these questions in their lives. So thank you again for that opportunity.
Well, as Anne Streber always says, the human species is too young for beliefs. What we need are good questions, and John has brought some fine questions to us today.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.